the doctor out." He struggled up from the sofa, wincing badly as he did it. His sister watched him, concerned, but he was clearly determined to escort me. So she gave in, and offered me her worn, well-shaped hand for another shake. "Goodbye, Dr. Faraday. I'm so glad we found that picture. Think of us, won't you, when you look at it?"
"I will," I said.
I followed Roderick from the room, blinking slightly at the plunge back into shade. He led me off to the right, past more shut doors, but soon the passage lightened and widened, and we emerged in what I realized was the entrance hall of the house. And here I had to pause and look around me, for the hall was very lovely. Its floor was of pink and liver-coloured marble, laid down like a checkerboard. The walls were pale wooden panels, ruddy with reflected colour from the floor. Dominating it all, however, was the mahogany staircase, which rose in an elegant, soft, square spiral through two more floors, its polished, serpent-headed banister climbing in a single, unbroken line. It made a stairwell 15 feet wide and easily 60 feet high, and it was lit coolly and kindly by a dome of milky glass in the roof above.
"A nice effect, that, isn't it?"
said Roderick, seeing me gazing upwards.
"The dome was a devil, of course, in the blackout."
He tugged open the broad front door. The door had got damp at some point in the past and was faintly buckled, and grated horribly against the marble as it moved. I joined him at the top of the steps, and the heat of the day billowed in around us. He grimaced.
"Still blistering, I'm afraid. I don't envy you the run back to Lidcote. What's that you're driving? A Ruby? How do you find her?"
The car was a very basic model, and there wasn't much to admire in her, but he was clearly the sort of boy to be interested in motors for their own sake, so I took him over and pointed out a couple of features, finally opening up the bonnet to show him the layout of the engine. I said, as I closed the bonnet again,
"These country roads rather punish her."
"I'll bet. How far do you take her day by day?"
"On a light day, 15, 20 calls. A heavy day might have more than 30. Local, for the most part, though I've a couple of private patients as far out as Banbury."
"You're a busy man."
"Too busy, at times."
"All those rashes and cuts? Oh, and that reminds me."
He put his hand to his pocket.
"How much do I owe you for seeing to Betty?"
I didn't want to take his money at first, thinking of his mother's generosity with the family photograph. When he pressed me, I said I would send him out a bill, but he laughed and said,
"Look here, if I were you, I'd take the money while it's offered."
"How much do you charge? 4 shillings? More?
Come on, we're not at the charity case stage just yet."
So I reluctantly said I would take 4 shillings, for the visit and the prescription. He brought out a warm handful of small coins and counted them into my palm. He changed his pose as he did it, and the movement must have jarred with him somehow. That puckering reappeared at his cheek, and this time I almost commented on it. As with the cigarettes, however, I didn't like to embarrass him, so let it go. He folded his arms and stood as if quite comfortable while I started the car, and as I moved off he languidly raised his hand to me, then turned and headed back to the house. But I kept my eye on him through my rear-view mirror, and saw him making his painful-looking way up the steps to the front door. I saw the house seem to swallow him up as he limped back into the shadowy hall. Then the drive made a turn between unclipped bushes. The car began to dip and lurch, and the house was lost to me. That night, as I often did on a Sunday, I had dinner with David Graham and his wife Anne. Graham's emergency case had gone well, against some substantial odds, so we spent most of the meal discussing it, and only as we were starting on our baked apple pudding did I mention that I'd been out to Hundreds Hall that day on his behalf. He at once looked envious.
"You have? What's it like there now? The family haven't called me out in years. I hear the place has gone badly downhill. They're rather pigging it, in fact."
I described what I had seen of the house and gardens. "It's heartbreaking," I said, "to see it all so changed. I don't know if Roderick knows what he's doing. It doesn't look much like it."
"Poor Roderick," said Anne. "He's a nice sort of boy, I've always thought. One can't help but feel sorry for him."
"Because of his scars and all that?"
"Oh, partly. But more because he seemed so out of his depth. He had to grow up too quickly. All those boys of his age did. But he had Hundreds to think about, as well as the war, and he isn't his father's son, somehow."
"Well," I said, "that might be in his favour. I remember the Colonel is rather a brute of a man, don't you? I saw him once, when I was young, going off pop with a motorist whose car, he said, had startled his horse. In the end, he jumped out of his saddle and kicked the car's headlamp in.
"He had a temper, certainly," said Graham, spooning up his apple. "The old-fashioned squire type."
"Old-fashioned bully, in other words."
"Well, I shouldn't have liked his job. He must have been out of his mind with money, what is half the time. I think that estate was already losing income when he inherited it. I know he sold land all through the 20s. I remember my own father saying it was like shoveling water from a sinking boat. I heard that the duties after he died were astronomical. How that family keeps going at all beats me."
I said, "And what about Roderick's smash? His leg looked bad," I thought. I wondered if a course of electrical therapy would help him, assuming he'd ever let me close enough to try. They seem to pride themselves on living like the Brontes out there, cauterizing their own wounds and whatnot. Would you mind? Graham shrugged.
"Be my guest. As I said, they haven't called me out in so long, I barely qualify as their doctor. I remember the injury. A nasty break, poorly reset. The burns speak for themselves."
He ate a little more, then grew thoughtful.
"There was a touch of nervous trouble, too, I believe, when Roderick first came home."
This was news to me.
"Really?
It can't have been too bad. He is certainly relaxed enough now."
"Well, it was bad enough for them to want to be a bit hush-hush about it. But then all those families are touchy like that. I don't think Mrs. Ayres even called in a nurse. She looked after Roderick herself, then brought Caroline home to help her at the end of the war. Caroline was doing quite well, wasn't she? With some sort of commission in the Wrens or the WAF. Awfully brainy girl, of course."
He said brainy in the way I had heard other people say it when discussing Caroline Ayres, and I knew that, like them, he was using the word more or less as a euphemism for plain. I didn't answer, and we finished our puddings in silence. Anne put her spoon into her bowl, then rose from her chair to close a window. We were eating late and had a candle lit on the table. It was just beginning to be twilight, and moths were fluttering around the flame. And as she sat back down, she said,
"Do you remember the first daughter out at Hundreds? Susan, the little girl that died. Pretty, like her mother. I went to her 7th birthday party. Her parents had given her a silver ring with a real diamond in it. Oh, how I coveted that ring. And a few weeks later she was dead. Was it measles? I know it was something like that."
Graham was wiping his mouth with his napkin. He said,
"Diff, wasn't it?"
She pulled a face at the thought.
"That's right. Such a nasty way. I remember the funeral. The little coffin and all the flowers. Heaps and heaps of them."
And I realized then that I remembered the funeral, too. I remembered standing with my parents on Lidcote High Street while the coffin went by. I remembered Mrs. Ayres, young, heavily veiled in black, like a ghastly bride. I remembered my mother quietly weeping, my father with his hand on my shoulder, the stiff, new, sour-smelling colours of my school blazer and cap. The thought depressed me for some reason more than it ought to have done. Anne and the maid took away the dishes, and Graham and I sat on at the table, discussing various business matters. And that depressed me even more. Graham was younger than me, but was doing rather better. He had entered the practice as a doctor's son, with money and standing behind him. I had come in as a sort of apprentice to his father's partner, Dr. Gill, that character, as Roderick had quaintly called him. Actually, the devil of an idle old man, who, under pretense of being my patron, had let me gradually buy out his stake in the business over many long, hard, poorly paid years. Gill had retired before the war and lived in a pleasant, half-timbered house near Stratford-on-Avon. I had only very recently begun to make a profit. Now, with the health service looming, private doctoring seemed done for. On top of that, all my poorer patients would soon have the option of leaving my list and attaching themselves to another man, thereby vastly reducing my income. I had had several bad nights over it. "I shall lose them all," I told Graham now, putting my elbows on the table and wearily rubbing my face.
"Don't be an idiot," he answered. "They've no more reason to leave you than they have to leave me, or Seeley, or Morrison."
"Morrison gives them any amount of cough mixture and liver salts," I said. "They like that. Seeley has his manners, his little ways with the ladies. You're a nice, clean, handsome sort of family chap. They like that, too. They don't like me. They never have. They've never been able to place me. I don't hunt or play bridge, but I don't play darts or football either. I'm not grand enough for the gentry. Not grand enough for the working people, come to that. They want to look up to their doctor. They don't want to think he's one of them.
Oh, rubbish! All they want is a man who can do the job, which you eminently can. If anything, you're too conscientious. You've too much time to fret in. You ought to get married. That'd sort you out.
I laughed.
God, I can barely keep myself, let alone a wife and family.
He had heard it all before, but tolerantly let me grumble on. Anne brought us coffee, and we talked until almost 11. I should have been happy to stay longer, but guessing what little time the two of them must get alone together, I at last said good night. Their house is just on the other side of the village from mine, a 10-minute walk away. The evening was still so warm and airless, I went slowly by a roundabout route, pausing once to light a cigarette, then slipping off my jacket, loosening my tie, and going on in my shirt sleeves. The ground floor of my house is given over to a consulting room, dispensary, and waiting room, with my kitchen and sitting room on the floor above and a bedroom in the attic. It was, as I'd told Caroline Ayres, a very plain sort of place. I'd never had time or money to brighten it, so it still had the same dispiriting decorations it had had when I'd moved in, mustard walls and combed paintwork, and a cramped, inconvenient kitchen. A daily woman, Mrs. Rush, kept things tidy and cooked my meals. When not actually dealing with patients, I spent most of my time downstairs, making up prescriptions or reading and writing at my desk. Tonight I went straight through to my consulting room to look over my notes for the following day, and put my bag in order, and it was only as I opened the bag up and saw the loosely wrapped brown paper parcel inside it that I remembered the photograph Mrs. Ayres had given me out at Hundreds Hall. I undid the paper and studied the scene again, and then, still unsure about that fair-haired nursemaid and wanting to compare the picture with other photographs, I took it upstairs. In one of my bedroom cupboards there was an old biscuit tin full of papers and family keepsakes put together by my parents. I dug it out, carried it over to the bed, and began to go through it. I hadn't opened this tin in years and had forgotten what was in it. Most of its contents, I saw with surprise, were odd little fragments from my own past. My birth certificate was there, for example, along with some sort of christening notice. A furred brown envelope turned out to hold two of my milk teeth and a lock of my baby hair, unfeasibly soft and blonde. And then came a mess of whiskery scouting and swimming badges, school certificates, school reports, and records of prizes. The sequence of them all mixed up, so that a torn newspaper cutting announcing my graduation from medical school had snagged itself on a letter from my first headmaster, fervently recommending me for a scholarship to Leamington College. There was even, I was astonished to see, the very Empire Day medal that had been presented to me out at Hundreds Hall by our youthful Mrs. Ayres. It had been carefully wrapped in tissue paper, and it tumbled heavily into my hand, its coloured ribbon unfrayed, its bronze surface dulled but untarnished. But of my parents' own lives, I discovered, there was shockingly little record. I suppose there was simply not much record to be kept. A couple of sentimental wartime postcards with neat, bland, badly spelled messages, a lucky coin with a hole for a string hammered through it, a spray of paper violets. That was about it. I had remembered photographs, but there was only one photograph here, a fading postcard-sized thing with curling corners. It had been taken in a photographer's tent at a local mop fair, and it showed my mother and father as a courting couple, fantastically posed against an alpine backdrop, in a roped laundry hamper, meant to be the basket of a hot-air balloon. I set this picture beside the Hundreds group and looked from one to the other. The angle at which my balloonist mother was holding her head, however, together with the droop of a sad-looking feather on her hat, meant that I was still no wiser, and finally I gave the thing up. The mop fair photograph, too, had begun to look rather poignant to me, and when I gazed again at the scraps and cuttings recording my own achievements, and thought of the care and pride with which my parents had preserved them, I felt ashamed. My father had taken on debt after debt in order to fund my education. The debts had probably ruined his health. They had almost certainly helped weaken my mother. And what had been the result? I was a good, ordinary doctor. In another setting I might have been better than good, but I had started work with debts of my own, and after 15 years in the same small country practice, I was yet to make a decent income. I have never thought of myself as a discontented man. I have been too busy for discontentment to have had a chance to set in, but I've had occasional dark hours, dreary fits when my life, laid all before me, has seemed bitter and hollow and insignificant as a bad nut. And one of those fits came upon me now. I forgot the many modest successes of my career, and instead saw every failure. The mishandled cases, the missed opportunities, the moments of cowardice and disappointment. I thought of my undistinguished war years, spent here in Warwickshire, while my younger colleagues, Graham and Morrison, enrolled with the RAMC. I felt the empty rooms below me, and remembered a girl with whom, as a medical student, I'd been very much in love. A girl from a good Birmingham family, whose parents hadn't considered me to be a suitable match, and who'd finally throw me over for another man. I had rather turned my back on romance after that disenchantment, and the few affairs I had had since then had been very half-hearted things. Now those passionless embraces came back to me too, in all their dry, mechanical detail. I felt a wave of disgust for myself, and a pity for the women involved. The heat in that attic room was stifling. I switched off my lamp and lit a cigarette, and lay down among the photographs and fragments on the bed. The window was open and the curtain pulled back. The night was moonless, but the dark was the uneasy dark of summer, fretful with subtle movement and sound. I gazed into it, and what I saw, a sort of curious afterimage of my day, was Hundreds Hall. I saw its cool, fragrant spaces, the light it held like wine in a glass, and I pictured the people inside it as they must be now. Betty in her room. Mrs. Ayres and Caroline in theirs. Roderick in his. I lay like that for a long time, open-eyed and unmoving, the cigarette burning slowly down, turning to ash between my fingers. Chapter 2. The fit of discontentment passed with the night. By the morning I had almost forgotten it. That day was the start of a brief, busy phase for Graham and me, for with the hot weather there had come a variety of small epidemics in the district, and now a bad summer fever began to do the rounds of the villages. One already delicate child was severely affected, and I spent a lot of time on him, calling in at the house sometimes two or three times a day until he was better. There was no money in it. He was a club patient, which meant I received only a handful of shillings for treating him and his brothers and sisters over the course of an entire year, but I knew his family well, and was fond of them, and was glad to see him recover, and the parents were touchingly grateful. I just about remembered, in the midst of all this, to send out Betty's prescription to the hall, but I had no further contact with her or with the Ayreses. I continued to pass the walls of Hundreds on my regular round, and now and then I'd catch myself thinking with something like wistfulness of the unkempt landscape beyond it, with that poor neglected house at its heart quietly sliding into decay. But as we turned the high point of summer and the season started to wane, that was as much thought as I began to give it. My visit to the Ayreses soon felt vaguely unreal, like some vivid but improbable dream. Then, one evening at the end of August, more than a month, in other words, since I had gone out to treat Betty, I was driving along one of the lanes outside Lidcott and caught sight of a large black dog sniffing around in the dust. It must have been 7:30 or so. The sun was still quite high in the sky, but the sky itself was beginning to pink. I'd finished my evening surgery and was on my way to visit a patient in one of the neighbouring villages. The dog started barking when he heard my car, and as he put up his head and moved forward, I saw the grey in his fur and recognised him as the elderly Hundreds Labrador, Jip. A second later I saw Caroline. She was right at the edge of the lane on the shadowy side. Hatless and bare-legged, she was reaching into one of the hedges, had managed to work her way into the brambles so completely without Jip to alert me, I would have driven past without spotting her. Drawing closer, I saw her call for the dog to be quiet. She turned her head to my car, narrowing her eyes against what must have been the glare of the windscreen. I noticed then that she had the strap of a satchel over her breast, and was carrying what I took to be an old spotted handkerchief, done up as a bundle like Dick Whittington's. Drawing level with her, I put on the brake and called through my open window, "Are you running away from home, Miss Ayres?" She recognized me then and smiled, and began to back out of the bushes. She did it gingerly, putting up a hand to free her hair from the brambles, then giving a final spring to the dusty surface of the road. Brushing down her skirt, she was dressed in the same badly fitting cotton frock she'd been wearing when I'd seen her last, she said, "I've been into the village doing errands for my mother, but then I got tempted from the path. Look!" She carefully opened the bundle up, and I realized that what I had taken for spots on the handkerchief were actually purple juice stains. She had lined the cloth with dock leaves and was filling it with blackberries. She picked out one of the largest berries for me, lightly blowing the dust from it before she handed it over. I put it into my mouth and felt it break against my tongue, warm as blood, and fantastically sweet. "Aren't they good?" she said as I swallowed. She gave me another, then took one for herself. "My brother and I used to come berrying here when we were young. It's the best spot for blackberries in the whole of the county. I don't know why. It can be dry as the Sahara everywhere else, but the fruit here are always good. They must be fed by a spring or something." She put her thumb to the corner of her mouth to catch a trickle of dark juice and pretended to frown. "But that was an Ayres family secret, and I shouldn't have blabbed. Now I'm afraid I may have to kill you. Or do you swear to keep the knowledge to yourself?"
"I swear," I said.
"Honour bright?"
I laughed. "Honour bright."
She warily gave me another berry. "Well, I suppose I shall have to trust you. It must be frightfully bad form to kill a doctor, after all, just a step or two down from shooting an albatross. Also quite hard, I imagine, since you must know all the tricks yourselves."
She tucked back her hair, seeming happy to talk, standing a yard or so from my window, tall and easy on those thickish legs of hers, and because I was mindful of the engine, idling away and wasting fuel, I switched it off. The car seemed to sink, as if glad to be released, and I became aware of the treacly weight and exhaustion of the summer air. From across the fields, muted by heat and distance, there came the grind and snap of farm machinery and calling voices. On those light, late August evenings, the harvesters worked until gone 11. Caroline picked out more fruit. She said, with a tilt of her head,
"You haven't asked after Betty."
"I was just about to," I said. "How has she been? Any more trouble?"
"Not a peep. She spent a day in bed, then made a miraculous recovery. We've been doing our best since then to make her feel more comfortable. We told her she needn't use the back stair any more if she doesn't like it, and Roddy's got hold of a wireless for her. That's bucked her up no end. Apparently they used to have a wireless at home, but it got broken in some argument. Now one of us has to drive into Lidcote once a week to recharge the battery, but we think it's worth it, if it keeps her happy. Tell the truth, though. That medicine you sent over was pure chalk, wasn't it? Was there ever anything wrong with her?"
"I couldn't possibly say," I answered loftily. "The patient-doctor bond and all that. Besides, you might sue for malpractice."
"Ha!" Her expression grew rueful. "You're on safe ground there. We couldn't afford the lawyer's fees."
She turned her head as Jip let out two or three sharp barks. While we had been talking, he had been nosing his way through the grass at the edge of the lane, but now there was an agitated flapping on the other side of the hedge, and he disappeared into a gap in the brambles.
"He's going after a bird," Caroline said. "The old fathead. These used to be our birds once, you know. Now they're Mr. Milton's. He won't like it if Jip gets hold of a partridge. Jip! Jippo! Come back! Come here, you idiotic thing!"
Hastily thrusting the bundle of blackberries at me, she went off in pursuit. I watched her leaning into the hedge, parting the brambles to reach and call, apparently unafraid of spiders or thorns, her brown hair catching again. It took her a couple of minutes to retrieve the dog, and by the time she had done that and he had trotted back to the car, looking terribly pleased with himself, with his mouth open and his pink tongue loose, I had remembered my patient and said I should be going.
"Well, take some berries with you," she said good-naturedly as I restarted the engine.
But seeing her begin to separate the fruit, it occurred to me that I would be driving more or less towards Hundreds, and since it was a good 2 or 3 miles journey, I offered her a lift. I hesitated about doing it, not knowing if she'd care to accept. Apart from anything else, she looked very much at home there on the dusty country lane, rather as a tramp or a gypsy would.
She seemed to hesitate, too, once I had asked her, but it turned out she was simply thinking the thing over. Glancing at her wristwatch, she said,
"I'd like that very much, and if you could bear to drop me at the lane to our farm instead of at the park gates, I'd be even more grateful. My brother's there. I'm going to leave him to it. I expect they'd be glad of some help, though. They usually are."
I said I'd be happy to. I opened up the passenger door to let Jip into the back, and once he had turned and slithered fussily about for a second or two on the rear seat, she moved the front seat back into place and got in beside me. I felt the weight of her as she sat in the tilt and creak of the car, and I suddenly wished that the car weren't quite so small and so ancient. She didn't seem to mind it, however. She placed the satchel flat on her knees and rested the bundle of berries on top and gave a sigh of pleasure, apparently grateful to be sitting down. She was wearing her flat, boyish sandals, and her bare legs were still unshaven. Each little hair, I noticed, was laden with dust, like an eye-black lash. Once I'd moved off, she offered me another blackberry, but this time I shook my head, not wanting to eat up all her crop. When she had taken one herself, I asked after her mother and her brother.
"Mother's fine," she answered, swallowing. "Thanks for asking. She was very glad to meet you that time. She does like to know who's who in the county. We go about so much less than we used to, you see, and she's rather proud about visitors, with the house so shabby, so she feels a bit cut off. Roddy is, well, how he usually is, working too hard, eating too little. His leg is a nuisance."
"Yes, I wondered about that."
"I don't know how much it really troubles him. Quite a lot, I suspect. He says he hasn't time to get it treated. What he means, I think, is that there isn't the money for it."
This was the second time she had mentioned money, but now there was no trace of ruefulness in her voice. She spoke as if merely stating a fact. Changing gear at a bend in the road, I said, "Are things as bad as that?" And then, when she didn't answer at once, "Do you mind my asking?"
"No, I don't mind. I was just thinking about what to say. They're pretty bad, to be honest with you. I don't know how bad, because Rod does all the bookkeeping himself, and he's quite cagey. All he ever says is that he's going to pull things through. We both try and keep the worst of it from Mother, but it must be obvious even to her that things at Hundreds will never be what they were. We've lost too much land, for one thing. The farm's more or less our only income now, and the world's a changed place, isn't it? That's why we've been so keen to hang on to Betty. I can't tell you what a difference it's made to Mother's spirits, our being able to ring for a servant in the old-fashioned way, instead of having to traipse down to the kitchen for a jug of hot water or something ourselves. That sort of thing means such a lot. We had servants at Hundreds, you see, right up to the war."
Again she spoke matter-of-factly, as if to someone of her own class. But she was still for a second, and then she moved as if self-conscious, saying in a quite different voice,
"God, how shallow you must think us. I'm so sorry."
I said, "Not at all." But it was clear what she meant, and the obviousness of her embarrassment only served to embarrass me. The road we had taken, too, was one I remembered going up and down as a boy at just about this time of year, carrying out the midday snap of bread and cheese to my mother's brothers as they helped with the Hundreds harvest. No doubt those men would have been very tickled to think that, 30 years on, a qualified doctor, I would be driving up that same road in my own car with the squire's daughter at my side. But I felt overcome, suddenly, with an absurd sense of gaucheness and falseness, as if, had my plain labourer uncles actually appeared before me now, they would have seen me for the fraud I was, and laughed at me. So for a while I said nothing, and neither did Caroline, and all our former ease seemed lost. It was a shame, for the drive was a pleasant one, the hedges colourful and fragrant, thick with dog-rose and red valerian and creamy white keck. Where the bushes gave way to gates, one caught glimpses of the fields beyond them, some stripped already to stubble and soil and being picked over by rooks, some still with wheat in them, the pale of the crop streaked scarlet with poppies. We reached the end of the Hundreds farm lane, and I slowed the car in preparation for turning into it, but she straightened up as if ready to get out.
"Don't trouble to take me all the way down. It's no distance."
"Are you sure?"
"Quite sure."
"Well, all right." I supposed she had had enough of me, and couldn't blame her. But when I had put on the brake and let the engine idle, she reached to the catch of her door, then paused with her hand upon it. Half turning to me, she said awkwardly,
"Thank you so much for the lift, Dr. Faraday. I'm sorry to have gone on before. I expect you think what most people must think, when they've seen hundreds as it is nowadays, that we're absolutely mad to go on living there, trying to keep it the way it was, that we ought to just give up. The truth is, you see, we know how lucky we are to have lived there at all. We have to sort of keep the place in order, keep up our side of the bargain. That can feel like an awful pressure sometimes.
Her tone was simple and very sincere, and her voice, I realized, was a pleasant one, low and melodious, the voice of a much handsomer woman, so that I was very much struck by it, there in the close, warm twilight of the car. My complicated feelings began to unravel. I said, "I don't think you're in the least bit mad, Miss Ayres. I only wish there was something I could do to make your family burdens lighter. That's the doctor in me, I suppose. Your brother's leg, for example. I've been thinking, if I could take a good look at it..." She shook her head.
"That's kind of you. But I really meant it just now when I said there wasn't the money for treatments."
"How about if it were possible to waive the fee?"
"Well, that would be even kinder. But I don't think my brother would see it that way. He has a silly sort of pride when it comes to things like that."
"Ah," I said. "But there might be a way around that, too." I'd had this idea at the back of my mind ever since my trip to Hundreds. Now I put it together properly as I spoke. I told her about the successes I'd had in the past in using electrical therapy to treat muscle injuries very like her brother's. I said that induction coils were rarely seen outside specialist wards, where they tended to be used on very fresh injuries, but that my hunch was their application could be far wider. "GPs need to be convinced," I said. "They need to see the evidence. I've got the equipment, but the right kind of case doesn't always come up. If I had an appropriate patient and was writing the work up as I went along, making a paper out of it, well, the patient would be doing me a kind of favour. I wouldn't dream of charging a fee." She narrowed her eyes.
"I begin to see the misty outline of a beautiful arrangement."
"Exactly. Your brother wouldn't even have to come to my surgery. The machine's very portable. I could bring it out to the hall. I couldn't swear it would work, of course, but if I were to get him wired up to it, say, once a week for 2 or 3 months, it's just possible he'd feel the benefits enormously. What do you think?"
"I think it sounds marvellous," she said, as if really delighted by the idea. "But aren't you afraid of wasting your time? Surely there are more deserving cases."
"Your brother's case seems pretty deserving to me," I told her. "And as for wasting time, well, to be quite honest with you, I don't think it'll do my standing at the district hospital any harm to be seen taking the initiative with a trial of this nature." That was perfectly true, though had I been really honest with her, I would have added that I also had hopes of impressing the local gentry, who, hearing perhaps of my success in treating Roderick Ayres's ailments, might, for the first time in 20 years, consider sending for me to take a look at their own. We talked the matter over for a minute or two, with the car engine idling, and since she grew more excited about it the more she heard, she at last said,
"Look, why not come up to the farm with me right now and put this to Roddy yourself?"
I glanced at my watch. "Well, there's a patient I promised to look in on."
"Oh, but can't they wait a little? Patients must be good at waiting. That's why they're called patients, surely. Just 5 minutes to explain it to him, just to tell him what you've told me."
She spoke now like a jolly sort of schoolgirl, and her manner was hard to resist. I said, "All right," and turned the car into the lane, and after a short, jolting ride we found ourselves in the cobbled yard of the farm. Ahead of us was the Hundreds farmhouse, a gaunt Victorian building. To our left were the cow pen and milking shed. We'd clearly arrived near the end of milking time, for only a small group of cows still waited, fretful and complaining to be taken in from their pen. The rest, about 50 of them, I guessed, could just be seen in the enclosure on the other side of the yard. We got out and, with Jip, began to pick our way over the cobbles. It was hard work. All farmyards are filthy, but this one was filthier than most, and the mud and slurry had been churned by hooves and then baked solid in ruts and peaks by the long dry summer. The shed, when we reached it, turned out to be an old wooden structure in a rather obvious state of dilapidation, reeking of manure and ammonia, and giving off heat like a glass hothouse. There were no milking machines, only stools and pails, and in the first two stalls we found the farmer, Makins, and his grown-up son, each at work on a cow. Makins had come in from outside the county a few years before, but I knew him by sight. A harassed-looking, lean-faced man in his early 50s, the very image of a struggling dairyman. Caroline called to him, and he gave us a nod, glancing at me in mild curiosity. We walked further, and, to my surprise, found Roderick. I'd guessed he was in the farmhouse, or busy in some other part of the farm, but here he was, milking along with the others, his face scarlet with heat and exertion, his long, lean legs folded up, and his forehead pressed into the cow's dusty brown flank. He looked up and blinked when he saw me. Not entirely pleased, I thought, to be caught at work like this, but doing a good job of hiding his feelings, for he called lightly, though without smiling,
"I hope you'll excuse me if I don't get up to shake your hand."
He looked at his sister. "Everything all right?"
"Everything's fine," she answered. "Dr. Faraday wants to talk to you about something, that's all."
"Well, I shan't be long. Settle down, you great daft thing."
His cow had started moving fretfully about at the sound of our voices. Caroline drew me back.
"They get skittish around strangers. They know me, though. Do you mind if I help?"
"Of course not," I said. She let herself into the cow-pen, slipping on a pair of Wellingtons and a filthy canvas apron, moving easily among the waiting animals, then driving one back into the shed and putting it to stand in the stall beside her brother's. Her arms were bare already, so she had no sleeves to roll up, but she washed her hands at a standpipe and gave them a swill with disinfectant. She brought over a stool and a zinc pail, put them down beside the cow, giving the cow a shove with her elbow as she did it, to bring it round to the right position, and set to work. I heard the noisy squirt of the milk in the empty bucket and saw the brisk, rhythmic movement of her arms. Taking a step to one side, I could just make out, beneath the cow's broad hindquarters, the flash of her hands tugging on the pale, impossibly elastic-looking udders. She had finished that cow and started on another before Roderick finished his. He led the beast out of the shed, emptied his pail of foaming milk into a scrubbed steel vat, then came over to me, wiping his fingers on his apron and jerking up his chin.
"What can I do for you?"
I didn't want to keep him from his work, so told him briefly what I had in mind, phrasing it all as if I were asking a favour, putting it to him that he'd be helping me out with some rather important research. The scheme sounded less convincing, somehow, than when I had described it to his sister in the car, and he listened with a very dubious expression, especially when I described the electrical nature of the machine.
"I'm sorry to say we haven't the fuel to run our generator during the day," he said, shaking his head as if that put an end to it. But I assured him that the coil ran off its own dry cells.
I could see Caroline watching us, and when she had finished with another cow she came and joined us, adding her arguments to mine. Roderick looked anxiously at the restless, waiting cattle as she spoke, and I think he agreed to the scheme in the end purely as a way of shutting us up. As soon as he could, he went limping over to the pen to fetch another beast for milking, and it was Caroline who fixed the date for me to come to the house.
"I'll make sure he's there," she murmured. "Don't worry."
And she added, as if just struck by the thought,
"Come long enough to stay for tea again, will you? I know Mother would want you to."
"Yes," I said, pleased. "I'd like to. Thank you, Miss Ayres." At that she put on a comically pained expression.
"Oh, call me Caroline, won't you? Lord knows I've years and years ahead of me of being dry Miss Ayres. But I'll still call you Doctor, if I may. One never quite likes to breach those professional distances, somehow."
Smiling, she offered me her warm, milk-scented hand, and we shook on it, there in the cowshed, like a couple of farmers sealing a deal. The date I made with her was for the following Sunday. Another warm day, as it turned out, with a parched, languished feel to it, and a sky made heavy and hazy with dust and grain. The square red front of the hall looked pale and curiously insubstantial as I approached, and only as I drew up on the gravel did it seem to come into proper focus. I saw again all the shabby detail, and even more than on my first visit, I had an impression of the house being held in some sort of balance. One could see so painfully, I thought, both the glorious thing it had recently been and the ruin it was on the way to becoming. At this time Roderick must have been looking out for me. The front door was drawn gratingly open, and he stood at the top of the cracked steps while I emerged from the car. When I made my way over to him with my doctor's bag in one hand, and in the other the induction coil in its neat wooden case, he gave a frown.
"This is the gadget you meant?"
"I was picturing something heftier.
This looks like something you'd keep sandwiches in. I said, it's more powerful than you'd think.
Well, if you say so,
let me show you to my room. He spoke as if rather regretting having agreed to the whole thing. But he turned and led me inside, taking me to the right of the staircase this time, and along another cool, dim passage. He opened up the last of its doors, saying vaguely, "I'm afraid it's a bit of a mess in here." I followed him in and set down my things, then looked about me in some surprise. When he had spoken of his room, I'd naturally been picturing an ordinary bedroom, but this room was huge, or seemed huge to me then, when I still hadn't quite acclimatized myself to the scale of things at Hundreds, with panelled walls, a latticework plaster ceiling, and a wide stone fireplace with a Gothic surround. "This used to be a billiard room," Roderick said to me, seeing my face. "My great-grandfather kitted it up. I think he must have fancied himself as some sort of baron, don't you? But we lost the billiard stuff years ago, and when I came home from the Air Force—home from hospital, I mean—well, it took me a while to be able to manage stairs and so on. So my mother and sister had the idea of putting a bed for me in here. I've grown so used to it, it's never seemed worth going back upstairs. I do all my work in here, too." "Yes," I said. "So I see." This was the room, I realized, that I had glimpsed from the terrace in July. It was even more of a jumble than it had seemed to me then. One corner was given over to a punishing-looking iron-framed bed with a dressing table close beside it, and next to that an antique washing-stand and mirror. Before the Gothic fireplace stood a couple of old leather armchairs, handsome enough, but both very scuffed and split at their seams. There were two curtained windows, one leading out via those convolvulus-choked stone steps to the terrace. In front of the other, and rather spoiling the lovely long line of it, Roderick had set up a desk and swivel chair. He had obviously put the desk there in order to catch the best of the northern daylight, but this also meant that its illuminated surface, which was almost obscured by a litter of papers, ledgers, folders, technical books, dirty teacups, and overflowing ashtrays, acted as a sort of magnet on the eye, irresistibly drawing one's gaze from every point in the room. The desk was clearly a magnet for Roderick in other ways, too, for even while talking to me he had gone across to it and started rooting about for something in the chaos. At last he produced a stub of pencil, then fished in his pocket for a scrap of paper and began copying down what looked like a series of sums into one of the ledgers. "Sit down, won't you?" he said to me over his shoulders. "I shan't be a tick. But I've just come back from the farm, and if I don't make a note of these blasted figures right now, I'm sure to forget." I did sit, for a minute or two, but as he showed no sign of joining me, I thought I might as well prepare my machine, so I brought it over and set it down between the two scuffed leather chairs, unhooking its lash and drawing off its case. I'd used the apparatus many times before, and it was simple enough, a combination of coil, dry-cell battery, and metal plate electrodes. But it looked rather daunting with its terminals and wires, and when I raised my head again I saw that Roderick had left his desk and was gazing down at it in some dismay. "Quite a little monster, isn't it?" he said, plucking at his lip. "You mean to set it going right now?" "Well," I said, pausing with the tangled leads in my hands, "I thought that was the idea. But if you'd rather not—"
"No, no, it's all right. Since you're here, we might as well get on with it. Do I strip off? Or how does it work?"
I said I thought we should get away with him simply rolling his baggy trouser leg up over the knee. He seemed glad not to have to undress in front of me, but once he had taken off his plimsoll and the much darned sock beneath it and seen to the trousers, he folded his arms, looking awkward.
"I feel like I'm joining the Freemasons. I don't have to swear an oath or anything."
I laughed. "In the first place, you simply have to sit here and let me examine you, if you don't mind. It won't take long." He lowered himself into the armchair, and I squatted before him and gently took hold of the injured leg, drawing it straight. As the muscle tightened, he gave a grunt of pain. "Not too much for you?" I asked. "I need to move it about a bit, I'm afraid, to get the feel of the injury." The leg was slender in my hands, thick with springing dark hair, but the skin had a yellowish, bloodless look, and in various spots on the calf and shin the hair gave way to polished pink dents and ridges. The knee was as pale and bulbous as some queer root and terribly stiff. The muscle of the calf was shallow and rigid, knotty with indurated tissue. The ankle joint, which Roderick was drastically overusing in compensation for the lack of movement above, looked puffy and inflamed. "Pretty foul, isn't it?" he said, in a more subdued tone as I tried the leg and foot in various positions. "Well, the circulation's sluggish, and there are a lot of adhesions. That's not good. But I've certainly seen worse. How's this? Ouch! Stinking. And this?" He jerked away.
"Christ! What are you trying to do? Twist the damn thing off?"
I gently took hold of the leg again and set it into its natural position, and spent a moment or two simply warming and working the rigid muscle of the calf between my fingers. Then I went through the process of wiring him up, soaking squares of lint with salt solution, fixing those to the electrode plates, putting the plates in position on his leg with elastic bindings. He leaned forward to watch me do it, looking more interested now. As I made a few final adjustments to the machine, he said, in a simple, boyish way,
"That's the condenser, is it?" "Yes, I see. And there's how you interrupt the current, I suppose. Look here, do you have a license for this? I'm not about to start sparking at the ears or anything."
I said, "I hope not. But let's just say the last patient I hooked up to this now saves a fortune on permanent waves." He blinked, mistaking my tone, taking me seriously for a second. Then he met my gaze, met it properly, for the first time that day, perhaps for the first time ever, finally seeing me. And he smiled. The smile lifted his features completely and drew attention from his scars. One saw the likeness between him and his mother. I said, "Are you ready?" He grimaced, more boyish than ever.
"I suppose so."
"Right, here goes." I threw the switch. He yelped, his leg jumping forward in an involuntary twitch. Then he started laughing. I said, "Not painful?"
"No, like pins and needles, that's all. Now it's hotting up. Is that right?"
"Perfect. Once the heat begins to fade, let me know, and I'll turn it up a bit." We spent 5 or 10 minutes like that, until the sensation of heat in his leg had reached a constant, which meant that the current had found its peak. I left the machine to look after itself then, and sat down in the second leather armchair. Roderick began to feel in his trouser pocket for his tobacco and packet of papers, but I couldn't bear to see him roll up one of his wretched little coffin nails again, so I got out my own case and lighter, and we helped ourselves to a cigarette each. He took a long draw on his, closing his eyes and letting his head grow loose on his slender neck. I said sympathetically, "You look tired." At once he made an effort to sit straighter.
"I'm all right. I was up at 6 this morning, that's all, for the milking. It isn't so bad in this weather, of course. It's in winter that one feels it. Having make-ins for a dairyman doesn't help, though."
"No? Why not?" He changed his pose again and spoke as if reluctantly.
"Oh, I oughtn't to complain. He's had it tough with this bloody heat wave. We've lost milk, we've lost grass. We've already had to start the herd off on next winter's feed. But he wants 1,000 impossible things and doesn't have a clue about how to achieve them. That's left to me, unfortunately."
I asked, "What sort of things?"
He said, with the same touch of reluctance, "Well, his big idea is for me to get an extension run out here from the water main. He wants me to bring out electricity while I'm at it. He says that even if the well fills up, the pump is just about ready to blow. He wants me to replace that. And he's started saying now that he thinks the milking shed's unsafe. He'd like me to pull it down and build a brick one. With a brick shed and an electric milker, we could start turning out accredited milk and make more of a profit. It's all he talks about."
He reached to a table at his side for a gunmetal ashtray, already crowded with worm-like stubs. I leaned across and tapped my cigarette into it too, saying, "Well, I fear he's right about the milk." Roderick laughed.
"I know he's right. He's right about it all. The farm's absolutely jiggered. But what the hell am I going to do about it? He keeps asking me, why can't I free up some capital? It's as though he's found the phrase in some magazine. I've told him frankly that Hundreds doesn't have any capital to free. He doesn't leave me. He sees us living here in this great house. He thinks we're sitting on piles of gold. He doesn't see us blundering around in the night with candles and tillies because we've run out of oil for the generator. He doesn't see my sister scrubbing floors, washing dishes in cold water." He jerked a hand towards his desk. "I've been writing letters to the bank, and putting an application together for a building license.
I spoke to a man at the district council yesterday about the water main and the electricity. He didn't give me much encouragement. He said we're too isolated out here to make it worth their while. But, of course, the whole thing has to be put down on paper. They need plans and surveyors' reports and God knows what else. That's so it can do the rounds of about 10 different departments, I suppose, before they reject it properly. He had started speaking almost unwillingly, but it was as if he had some sort of spring inside him, and his own words wound it. As he went on, I watched the bitter shifting about of his scarred, finely cut features, the restless dipping and rising of his hands, and suddenly remembered what David Graham had told me about his having had that touch of nervous trouble after his smash. I'd been supposing his manner to be rather casual all this time. Now I realized that the casualness was actually something else completely, perhaps an exhaustion, perhaps a studied warding off of anxiety, perhaps even a tension so complete and habitual it resembled languor. He became aware of my thoughtful gaze. He fell silent, drawing deeply on his cigarette again, and taking his time over exhaling. He said, in a different voice, "You mustn't let me run on. I can be a frightful bore about it." "Not at all," I answered. "I'd like to hear more." But he was clearly set on turning the subject, and for 5 or 10 minutes we discussed other things. Every so often, as we chatted, I moved forward to check his leg and to ask him how the muscle was feeling. "It's fine," he'd answer each time, but I could see his face growing flushed, so guessed he was suffering slightly. Soon it was clear that the skin had started to itch. He began to pick and rub at the edge of the electrodes. When I finally switched the thing off and removed the elastics, he worked his fingernails vigorously up and down his calf, grateful to be released. The treated flesh, as I'd expected, looked hot and moist, almost scarlet. I dried it off, shook powder on it, and spent another couple of minutes working the muscle with my fingers. But it was clearly one thing for him to be wired up to an impersonal machine, and quite another to have me, squatting before him, going over his leg with quick, warm, powdered hands. He shifted about impatiently, and at last I let him rise. He saw to his sock and plimsoll, and unrolled his trouser leg, all without speaking. But once he had taken a few paces across the room, he looked back at me and said, as if pleased and surprised, "You know, that's not too bad. That's really not too bad at all." I realized then how much I had wanted the thing to be a success. I said, "Walk again, and let me watch you." "Yes, you're definitely moving more freely. Just don't overdo it. It's a good start, but we must take things slowly. For now, you must keep that muscle warm. You've some liniment, I suppose?" He glanced doubtfully around the room. "I think they gave me some lotion or other when they sent me home." "Never mind, I'll give you a new prescription." "Oh, now look here. You mustn't trouble any more than you already have." "I told you, didn't I? You're doing me the favour." "Well." I'd anticipated exactly this, and had brought along a bottle in my bag. He took it from me, then stood gazing at the label while I went back to the machine. As I was tidying away the lint, there was a knock on the door, which startled me slightly, for I'd heard no footsteps. The room had those two great windows, but the wooden panelling on its walls gave it an insulated feel, as if it were the below-decks cabin of an ocean liner. Roderick called out, and the door was opened. Jip appeared, thrusting his way into the room and trotting straight to me, and behind him, more tentatively, came Caroline. She was wearing an Airtex blouse today, tucked haphazardly into the waistband of a shapeless cotton skirt. She said, "Are you cooked, Roddy?" "Quite fried," he answered. "And is that the machine? Crikey! Like something of Dr. Frankenstein's, isn't it?" She watched me lock the thing back in its case, then noticed her brother, who was absently flexing and bending his leg. She must have seen from his poise and expression the relief the treatment had brought him, for she gave me a serious, grateful look, which somehow pleased me almost more than the success of the therapy itself. But then, as if embarrassed by her own emotion, she turned away from me to pick up a stray piece of paper from the floor, and began complaining light-heartedly about Roderick's untidiness. "If only there was some sort of machine for keeping rooms in order," she said. Roderick had unstoppered the bottle of liniment and was lifting it to his nose. "I thought we had one of those already. It's called Betty. Or else, why do we pay her?" "Don't listen to him, Doctor. He never lets poor Betty in here." "I can't keep her out," he said.
and she moves things around where I can't find them, and then pretends she hasn't touched them."
He spoke absently now, already having drifted back to that magnetic desk of his, the bottle put aside and his leg forgotten. And when he had opened up the cover of a dog-eared manila file and was frowning down at it, he began, just as automatically, to bring out papers and tobacco in order to roll a cigarette. I saw Caroline watching him, her expression growing serious again.
"I wish you'd give those filthy things up," she said.
She went to one of the oak-panelled walls and ran her hand across the wood.
"Look at these poor panels. The smoke's ruining them. They ought to be waxed or oiled or something."
"The whole house needs something," said Roderick, yawning. "If you know a way of doing something with nothing, no money, I mean, then go ahead, be my guest. Besides," he'd raised his head and caught my eye and made another obvious effort to speak more brightly, "it's a fellow's duty to smoke in this room, wouldn't you say, Dr. Faraday?"
He gestured to the lattice-work ceiling, which I had taken to be ivory-coloured with age, but which I now realized had been stained an irregular nicotine yellow by half a century's worth of cigar-puffing billiard players. Soon he returned to his papers, and Caroline and I took the hint and left him. He promised, with a touch of vagueness, that he would shortly join us for tea. His sister shook her head.
"He'll be in there for hours now," she murmured as we moved away from his door. "I wish he'd let me share the work with him, but he never will. His leg was really better, though, wasn't it? I can't thank you enough for helping him like this."
"He could help himself," I said, "by doing the right kind of exercises. Or a bit of simple massage every day would make a great deal of difference to the muscle. I've given him some liniment. You might see that he uses it."
"I'll do my best. But I expect you've noticed how careless of himself he is."
She slowed her step.
"What do you think of him, honestly?"
I said, "I think he's fundamentally very healthy. I think he's charming, too, by the way. It's a pity he's been allowed to organize his rooms like that, with the business side of things dominating everything else."
"Yes, I know.
Our father used to run the estate from the library. It's his old desk that Roderick uses, but I never remember it looking so chaotic in the old days. And that was with four farms to manage, not just one. We had an agent to help us then, mind. A Mr. MacLeod. He had to leave us during the war. He had an office of his own just back there. This side of the hall was the men's side, if you know what I mean, and always busy. Now, apart from Roderick's room, this whole section of the house might as well not be here at all." She spoke casually, but it was novel and curious to me to think of having grown up in a house with so many spare rooms in it they could be shut up and forgotten. When I said this to Caroline, however, she gave that rueful laugh of hers. "The novelty soon wears off, I assure you. One starts to think of them pretty quickly as something like tiresome poor relations, for one can't abandon them completely, but they have accidents, or fall ill, and finish by using up more money than would have been needed to pension them off. It's a shame, because there are some quite nice features here. But I could show you over the house if you'd like, if you promise to avert your gaze from the worst bits. The sixpenny tour. What do you say?" She seemed genuinely keen to do it, and I said I'd like it very much, if it wouldn't mean keeping her mother waiting. She said, "Oh, mother's a true Edwardian at heart. She thinks it a barbarism to take tea before 4 o'clock. What time is it now?" It was just after 3:30.
"We've plenty of time. Let's start at the front."
She snapped her fingers for Jip, who had gone trotting on ahead, and took me back past her brother's door.
"The hall you've seen, of course," she said,
when we reached it and I had set down my therapy machine and bag.
"The floor's Carrara marble, hence the vaulted ceilings in the rooms underneath. It's a devil to polish. The staircase, considered quite a feat of engineering when it was put in because of the open second landing. There aren't many others quite like it. My father used to say it was like something from a department store. My grandmother refused to use it. It gave her vertigo. Over there's our old morning room, but I won't show you that. It's quite empty and far too shabby. Let's go in here instead."
She opened a door on a darkened room, which, once she had gone across to the shuttered windows and let in some light, revealed itself as a pleasant, largish library. Most of its shelves, however, were hung with dust sheets, and some of its furniture was obviously gone. She reached into a mesh-fronted case and carefully drew out a couple of what she said were the house's best books, but I could see that the room was not what it had been, and there wasn't much to linger for. She went to the fireplace to peer up the chimney, concerned about a fall of soot in the grate. Then she closed the shutter and led me to the neighbouring room, at the old estate office she had already mentioned, which was panelled like Roderick's and had similar Gothic touches. Her brother's door was next, and just beyond that was the curtained arch which led to the basement. We went quietly past them both and found the boot room.